I object!
And why is that, Mr. Reed?
Because it's devastating to my case!
I did, you know, the murders, but as you're all so looking forward to this, I thought I'd plead not guilty. Oh.
They say a man who represents himself has a fool for a client. Well, with God as my witness, I am that fool.
Mr. Simpson, this is the most blatant case of fraudulent advertising since my suit against the film The Neverending Story.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode number 160. Nice even number there. How's it going, Andrew?
It's going great. How's it going with you?
Going okay. About to see a bunch of fine folks at AACon in Oklahoma. Beautiful Oklahoma. Someplace I've always dreamed of going.
I really wish I could join you. I love meeting up with our fans and going to conventions and the like. So everybody go up and give Thomas a big hug in Oklahoma.
So. Yeah, I was going to say, buy me a drink for Andrew and me. And then I realized that's going to be one of those drinking games that just does not end well. I can't keep up with right. that. All right. Well, we've got a fun show for you. We've got the Schrodinger's Andrew. We've got
there
Andrew
you go.
Was wrong and not wrong. And we're going to pop open that box and see which Andrew is there. Is it the not wrong Andrew or is it the wrong Andrew? We've got a lot of stuff that Andrew was absolutely not wrong about. And we got some few things Andrew was wrong about. It's going to be fun. I like it. Schrodinger's Andrew. Their new episode name.
We're definitely using that as the episode title.
It took a second to figure out how to say that, but I got it. But before that, what's give us a March Madness update.
All right. Yeah, we had 95 people play. I think I called out one of our listeners for submitting a joke entry and trying to get the largest number wrong. And that person replied on the Facebook community that they were a bit hurt by that characterization. And they were, in fact, intending to win. Why you would have picked South Dakota State to win it all if you were. But nevertheless, we have 95. Five series entries. Sadly, fan favorite Liz Weeks has been eliminated along with her beloved Syracuse Orange. As far as I can tell, five people, right? There are two more rounds of games left, right? Saturday are the final four games and then the championship game next week. And as far as I can tell, five people can win this pool. Mm. Here's how. Okay. Our current leaders are Chris Eilers and Drew Niewoehner. We talked about Drew last week. They need Cinderella Loyola Chicago to beat Michigan. Nobody in our entire pool took Michigan to win the whole thing, but a lot of people do have them in the finals. And so if Michigan beats Loyola Chicago, a bunch of people below Drew and Chris will get
points. Oh, I was going to say, so it's not like they picked Loyola. They just need the other team to not win.
Correct. They need nobody to be getting points.
Gotcha.
So if Loyola, and by the way, I will point out when I was visiting my parents when we recorded the Stormy Daniels episode, visiting my parents in Florida, and my dad said Loyola Chicago is my sleeper team, and he's actually in the pool.
Oh my
gosh. So when I talked to him, I was like, yeah, so how far do you have him going? He was like, well, Sweet 16, I thought that was pretty impressive. So, but my dad actually did call that. He said, I watched a lot of Loyola Chicago play, and they're really good. So if Loyola Chicago continues their improbable Cinderella run and they win the next two games and the national championship, then Chris Eilers wins. If Kansas beats Loyola Chicago, then Drew Niewoehner wins. Now, so that's scenarios one and two.
Yeah, I
scenario
love
number
the intensity
three.
Of this breakdown is
yeah,
great.
I did
you
more
want to be a sportscaster, don't you?
Yeah, than I did for the show, actually, this week. It took 21 hours to run the scenario.
You're
going to
do all this and explain, and then the show will be like, so motions
so stuff
to
happened. Yeah, stuff happened this
do
week,
I don't know, legal term.
All right, scenario number three. if Kansas, so now all the rest of these are if Michigan beats Loyola Chicago. Mm-hmm. So scenario number three is Michigan beats Loyola Chicago and then Kansas beats Michigan. And in that scenario, Chris Lane, who is in 22nd place right now, but has Kansas winning the whole thing, will jump all the way up and will win. Will win. And on the other hand, if Michigan faces Villanova and the Villanova Wildcats win the national championship, then Isaac Drips will jump up from 14th place to win. And that would leave, by process of elimination, what happens if Loyola Chicago loses to Michigan, and then on the other side of the bracket, Villanova beats Kansas, and then Michigan wins the national title. We've already said nobody in our pool picked Michigan to win. In that case, Thomas, I am delighted to tell you that you and Stephanie St. Amour, both of whom you are currently tied for 9th place, would finish in a tie for first.
Oh, wow.
You would edge out Isaac and our buddy Eric Brewer by 1 point. And so you should be rooting for
Michigan to
win the national championship.
Okay.
And you need to root for Villanova to beat Kansas. Huh. If that happens, it will go to the tiebreaker, which is
Weird is, don't I have Villanova for the championship?
Yeah. Yeah. But if Villanova wins, then other people will beat you out. I know it seems totally weird. You need Villanova not to get the points and Michigan to win.
Interesting.
And so if that happens, then you'll get the points. You'll get the 16 points for Villanova.
The only thing
coming
I'm questioning with this is, I know I have Villanova, and you're saying Villanova needs to win to get to the championship. So it's
and then
it's
lose in the championship game to Michigan.
Yeah, but I don't have Michigan, so it's confusing to me how, in a game where only Villanova is getting points and I have Villanova as the champion, how could that make me lose? I question.
I ran through the math because, well, we'll have to look and find out. But I ran through the math. I felt pretty good.
Can't
about
wait
it.
To do this. Andrew was wrong segment on.
So you are rooting for Michigan to win the national championship. And the reason I think the answer to that is because other people with Villanova winning the entire thing are ahead of you in the standings.
Yeah.
Right. And you've got Michigan coming out on the other side.
I don't have Michigan winning the championship. So I struggle to understand how that could be true, but I'll take your word for it. You're the ESPN college basketball analyst we brought on.
There
the
we
show.
Go.
All right.
And if that happens, we would go to the tiebreaker. We would go to points in the final game. Yeah.
I think I picked my pick might have been a little too high. I just went based on the average points, but these games seem really low scoring, so mine might be high.
You picked 141. Stephanie picked an insanely high number. She picked 178.
Oh, okay. So, I got it. So if that happens,
I feel pretty good that you're going to win, unless it's the tipping point is 160, right? So if it's 81-80 or better in favor of Michigan, then Stephanie will win.
These games have been so low scoring that I've been seeing.
They really have been. Yeah. So
all right. Well, thanks for that breakdown.
There's our March Madness
ESPN analyst Andrew Torres, everybody. Wow. All right, well, let's get a lawyer Andrew on.
Yes, that's what the show is really about. And everybody else who fast forwarded through the college basketball segments can tune right in right here.
But that was fun. Thanks for doing that, everybody. And thanks for leaving some chance of me winning. That's always nice. I appreciate it. All right. In the we've got a Schrodinger's Andrew in a box, and there's a particle that's superposition. We don't know how. And we're going to crack open that box and find out what Andrew was not wrong about. Here we go.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
Nobody so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse. Yeah, I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
Okay. Obviously, we're going to talk about a lot of stormy news in this segment, but I want to begin with an indictment that was handed down yesterday. This was in the Mueller investigation, and this is an indictment of a figure that we have not heard about to date named Alex van der Zwaan. Okay. He is a 33-year-old Dutch national who speaks Russian. He was Paul Manafort's lawyer. He worked for a law firm called Skadden Arps, which is, again, one of these Covington-style
called criminal assassin and yeah, gosh.
Yes, Manafort. Exactly.
Yeah.
And this kid was in his late 20s and early 30s when he was doing the work for, I mean, he's 33 now. So, I mean, you know, you can figure out, you know, he was a young guy when he was assigned to Paul Manafort. And there's a little bit, I mean, but for the fact that he engaged in blatantly criminal conduct, there's a little bit of my heart that sort of goes out to him, because I know what it's like to be a go-getter associate in the Skadden Arps firm, in a firm like that, and to be out there. And you really do get the directives of like, hey, yeah, Manafort's firm was paying millions of dollars a year in legal fees. And, and you do get these pressures of like, hey, whatever the client wants, whatever the client needs. Now, all of that being said, what did this guy do? This guy deliberately lied to the Mueller investigation. And in particular, right, he is Manafort's and Gates's lawyer, and he lied about communications between himself and Rick Gates, who is now flipped and is cooperating with the Justice Department. And this is the crucial part of Yodel Mountain. He lied about communications between a person who is referred to as Person A in the sentencing memorandum and communications between Person A and Manafort and Gates. And as it turns out, Person A is somebody that, here, I'm going to read from the sentencing memorandum.
Okay.
Federal Bureau of Investigation special agents assisting the special counsel's office assess that Person A has ties to Russian intelligence service and had such ties in 2016. During his first interview with the special counsel's office, Van der Zwaan admitted that he knew of that connection, stating that Gates told him that Person A was a former Russian intelligence officer. So in the course of the investigation, Van der Zwaan lied about that, those contexts, said that Manafort and Gates were not in communication with this Person A, when in fact they were in contact with Person A. Again, I've just read you from the sentencing memorandum. The government has proof that Person A is connected to Russian intelligence.
Wow. And so who wins the bracket challenge in that if they had, who had that?
Yeah. Oh, in September and October of 2016. Right. So 1 month before the election. So all of this, there's no connection between Trump and Russia. Russia is a ruse. The delightful.
Russia I tried not is to, a ruse.
That's really, your impression is really getting better. Mine remains terrible. So that's why I didn't do it. That connection has been established by the government in the sentencing memorandum. So what is a sentencing memorandum? I should say that. Ultimately, Van der Zwaan came in, interviewed with Mueller and lied to the Mueller investigation. He deleted a copy of this email from Person A to Van der Zwaan at his law firm's address. And
question, is that a good idea?
That's a terrible idea. And it's a terrible idea because, you know, forensic recovery makes it really, really easy to pick up emails. But what happened in this case was the government procured a copy of this email from somebody else, almost certainly from Rick Gates, right? Because
they
clearly
CC'd the whole office. I hate when they do that.
Yeah. Clearly what happened was Van der Zwaan forwarded the email on to Gates and said, hey, we need to talk about this. So let's describe what this email is. The email said in Russian that Person A, quote, would like to exchange a few
in
words.
Russian.
Yes.
Wow.
Van der Zwaan speaks Russian. I think I mentioned that, right? Yeah. But that Person A would like to exchange a few words via WhatsApp or Telegram, end of quote, with Manafort and Gates.
Nothing suspicious about that.
On September 12th, 2016. Van der Zwaan lied. He said that he had no idea why that email had not been produced to the government, and then further lied when he said that he had not communicated with Person A in response to the email. So then Mueller called Van der Zwaan back into his office and said, hey, look, we're going to indict you on 18 U.S.C. 1001. That is the provision of the code that we have talked about at great length in connection with the Mueller investigation, which imposes a sentence of up to 5 years in jail in connection with making a materially false statement or representation in any matter within the jurisdiction of the United States government. So lying to Mueller gets you up to 5 years in jail. And Van der Zwaan at that point, and this is a month and a half ago, pled guilty. So the sentencing memorandum is the government weighing in on, okay, this guy has now pled guilty. How should the court view this guy? And this memorandum says
Russian the government, hell.
Oh. Yeah, does not take a position with respect to the particular sentence to be imposed, but sets forth its view of the nature of the offense and the offender. And in this memorandum, which is just a, it's a short, we're going to link it in the show notes. It's seven pages long. It says, the defendant presents a scarcity of mitigating factors and several aggravating circumstances and describes how he derailed the Mueller investigation by deleting this email and lying about contacts between Manafort, Gates, and person A. I want to read a little bit from the sentencing memorandum because I think it helps cast some more light on Yodel Mountain. It says, Vanderzwan, in fact, had a series of calls with Gates and person A, as well as the lead partner on the matter, in September and October of 2016. The conversations concerned potential criminal charges in Ukraine about the Tymoshenko report and how the firm, that is Skadden Arps, was compensated for its work. And I want to say parenthetically, Skadden Arps prepared a report on behalf of Manafort's company that has been widely criticized by politicians on both sides of the aisle as totally inappropriate and designed to whitewash Paul Manafort's activities in Ukraine. Not directly relevant here, but that's the background for this. And Manafort's firm is paying $5 million a year to Skadden for this. So, you know, this poor guy gets called up by the senior partner and is like, hey, when are you going to talk to our client that owes us $5 million? Again, I've gotten those calls. So those are tough calls to get, right? The sentencing memorandum goes on. The calls were memorable. Vanderzwan had taken the precaution of recording the conversations with Gates, person A, and the senior partner who worked on the report. So there are audio tapes.
So, Lordy, there are tapes. Is that what you're saying?
Yep. In Vanderzwan's recorded conversation with person A, in Russian, person A suggested that there were additional payments and, quote, the official contract was only part of the iceberg and, most damningly, the story may become a blow, quote, for you and me personally, end quote. I can't wait. I mean, again, we've talked about this over the course of the Mueller investigation. The special prosecutor's office has these tapes in their hand. They have described them in public in the sentencing memorandum. I think, you know, again, is this a smoking gun? I don't, it's a warm gun, right? This is
happiness. Happiness is a warm gun. So.
Yeah, exactly. So this is continuing to document our, you know, we have multiple teams of Sherpas leading us up Yodel Mountain.
And, we don't know which one's going to win. That's a good,
I'm going to pass along
to the top of Yodel Mountain. Many paths, many ales waiting for us at the top.
Right. There is
there's more report- than one way to yodel a mountain is what we're saying.
Correct. That's exactly right. So there is a report I'm going to link in the show notes. I cannot validate the veracity of the investigation other than to say it's from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. The reporter is Christopher Miller, seems to be a trustworthy reporter. But again, all I can do is link it, who says person A is Konstantin Kalimnik, who seems to fit the facts as described in the sentencing memorandum, because the sentencing memorandum does, although it refers to him as person A, it does describe certain activities that could be used to kind of verify that up. So I'm going to link that. I have no idea. I don't know anything about it. But the important thing is the Mueller campaign has a recorded conversation from a lawyer and with Richard Gates. Presumably, they found out about it because Gates flipped, that directly links the one-time Trump campaign chair to Russian intelligence officials in September and October of 2016.
Is that what you were not wrong about? Did somebody suggest?
Yeah, I was not wrong that this was, because we got criticized in discussing the Manafort indictment. We got criticized on Twitter of, hey, look, this may all just be against Manafort, right? And, you know, and we represented that possibility, you know, certainly was among the potential options. We brought on friend of the show, Randall Eliason, reason to say that, yes, it certainly could just be that Mueller is only building his case against Manafort. But we said, you know, it's reasonable to think that the greater sheaf of outcomes probably includes gaining leverage against the White House and Trump's campaign operations. And here we have evidence of that. So
gotcha. Wow.
That's a moment one. I think we should stay on Yodel Mountain and talk about the latest Stormy news.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go over to we can kind of cut through to the other path up Stormy Mountain. I almost said that is kind of Stormy Mountain. So yeah. What's going on with Stormy's amended complaint?
Yeah. So here's what happened in episode 154. We broke down the Stormy Daniels complaint. And one of the things that I mentioned at the outset was that this was brought in state court. And immediately thereafter, in a move that kind of shocks me, I mean, it's why I didn't, there were a lot of things we couldn't discuss. We only had an hour. We needed to break down the entire complaint. But I thought about whether I should talk about the process of removing a complaint from state court to federal court. Right? Because if you are Donald Trump and Michael Cohen, you want this lawsuit to be in federal court for a number of reasons, right? Not the least of which is federal court judges are appointed by the president. So the federal bench in California tends to be more conservative than the state bench in California. Federal court judges, if the fundamental question is arbitration, federal court judges are, whether left or right, are very, very heavy-handed in favor of arbitration. So you are far more likely to get the relief that you want by being in federal court. But the reason I didn't discuss it is because in order to remove a case, first, let me say, on the law, can you remove this case to federal court? Absolutely. Right. And the way in which you remove this case to federal court is through diversity jurisdiction, which we've talked about before.
Yeah.
Stormy Daniels is a citizen of the state of California. Michael Cohen and Donald Trump are citizens of the state of New York. We want to argue Donald Trump is a citizen of the District of Columbia right now. You could do it. But either way, right, there is complete diversity. They're not in California. So you have diversity between the parties. And the amount in controversy must exceed $75,000 in interest. And, you know, clearly it does. But in order to get to federal court, the defendants have to file a notice of removal. Right? You have to tell the court, hey, the defendants have all gotten together and we all agree that this belongs in federal court. If the defendants don't agree, right, then you cannot file the notice of removal. You can litigate it, right? But you have to have all the defendants on the same page in order to file a notice of removal for diversity jurisdiction. And the fact that Donald Trump was named, I was like, well, obviously Donald Trump is not going to join in a motion, you know, in a notice of removal. And similarly, because in order to do so, he's going to have to concede that he's DD.
Yeah.
He's going to have to concede that he has interests under this contract. And if he does that, the game is over. Well, never underestimate
the Stormy Daniels legal team
So indeed this happened. Michael Cohen, on behalf of Essential Consultants LLC, filed a notice of removal to transfer
he said essentially not that Donald Trump has anything to do with this, nothing to do with it. However, he lives in New York, so let's can we move this to federal court? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying it's much worse than that.
Uh-oh, okay.
I'm saying the notice of removal, which we will link in the show notes, contains this statement in order to comply with, right? Because everybody knows where Donald Trump lives, mm-hmm. but you have to comply, in addition, you have to comply with the jurisdictional requirement that there's $75,000 or more in controversy. So here's what it says. Moreover, EC is aware of at least 20 violations by Clifford, Stormy Daniels, of the confidentiality provisions of the settlement agreement. Clifford expressly agreed in the settlement agreement to liquidated damages in the amount of $1 million for each breach of the confidentiality provisions of the settlement agreement. Therefore, EC and or defendant Trump have the right to seek liquidated damages against Clifford for her numerous breaches in an amount to be proven with certainty at the pending arbitration proceeding, but which is approximated to already be in excess of $20 million. And then, so, okay, Cohen is Trump's lawyer, but this was on behalf of EC. All right, maybe it's, you know, you could argue some kind of. Then Donald Trump, by and through his personal legal team, filed a joinder and adopted the EC brief. And thereby adopting the positions that were taken. So when we said earlier this week that Donald Trump has admitted that he's DD, he has now walked that back, right, and said, well, I never, you know, admitted that I was DD. I mean, and not him, agents on his behalf have walked that back. But this, it in my view, and I think in the view of any court, is going to constitute a judicial admission that he
was DD. Man, but this is kind of, I feel like this is what I predicted, where legally they'll go through with whatever and he'll be DD, but he'll just say, no, I'm not. And then people can't follow it because they don't, not enough people listen to opening arguments. That's it. We need to make opening arguments required listening for everybody in the country. I think that's step one. Let's do that.
I agree. I agree with that. That is clearly.
That's going to be a hell of a bracket pool. Yeah. I don't think I'm
we'll have
to
do the Warren Buffett, right? Like there'll be millions of people playing in 2019. That'd be great. Let's see if we can't get OA to a million listeners by 2019.
Yeah. So what you're saying is everybody needs to be asking him. Every journalist needs to be asking him, hey, what claims do you have in this lawsuit? You are DD, right? So what's the question precisely people should ask him now?
Yeah, we put it word for word in the show notes of the last episode.
Oh, there you go.
Episode,
let's keep pounding it through.
But again, yeah, I'll repeat it again in these show notes, right? It should be, okay, you've joined in this lawsuit. You've conceded that you have damages arising from Stormy Daniels' conduct. Can you tell us what those are?
Yeah.
So yeah,
what
now
did
we're in
she
federal
say
court.
That led to damages? I mean,
yeah. What materials does she have that caused you personal injury?
Interesting.
Because again, remember, this is the key to keep in the back of your mind. This is the one sentence with Uncle Frank. You can use a non-disclosure agreement to cover up things that are false. This is not a non-disclosure agreement. This is a settlement agreement. And a settlement agreement only protects you against things that are true.
Wow.
So now we're in federal court. Stormy Daniels could try and remand back that, but her said, okay, all right, we're in federal court. Great. What he did was amend the complaint. And that And you can do that. You get one free amendment to your complaint as of right in federal court. Yeah, you get a mulligan.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds like not very lawyerly. That's more like a board game or something. Okay, it's new round. Federal round, everybody. Now we get one. What happens if you roll a six when you...
Yeah. Never mind. So you get one freebie. Everything after that, you have to seek leave of the court. You have to get permission and you have to show that it's in the interest of justice. But so what he did was he amended the complaint. I'm going to link it in the show notes. I don't have time to go through all of the new factual allegations. I will tell you, as I said on Twitter, I have no intention of suing Stormy Daniels' lawyer, Michael Avenatti, for plagiarism, but these allegations really sound an awful lot like our opening arguments episode. They go into, and they say, you know, there's now specific allegations saying that the LLC was formed for an illegal purpose and is thus void as against public policy and unenforceable in California. You should read it, and you know
that's on us, Stormy Daniels and Co.
That's a freebie.
On us. Right. You can, enjoy.
Take that one back. The other thing he adds is a defamation complaint. He adds Michael Cohen individually as a defendant and adds a defamation complaint at the end, saying that Michael Cohen's statements that Stormy's story, quote, isn't true, end quote, was made with knowing falsity, right? We've talked about the New York Times v. Sullivan standard. If you say something that you know is false, that
so he can't
the
just say, well, yeah,
everywhere.
Someone told me that he can't get out of that because they could prove he knows it.
Correct. And he has made those statements publicly. You have a conditional privilege for things that you say in a lawsuit. That's I'm not going to get into the doctrine of conditional privilege, but he has said these things on CNN, right? Yeah. He has said these in public repeatedly.
He's now becoming part of the lawsuit himself. We got a William Jennings Bryan scenario. He's going to have to go on the stand.
And that is a fantastic segue to the second thing that Stormy Daniels' legal team has done, which is they've filed a motion for expedited trial. And you're probably sitting there going, well, that seems weird. Like, why? How does this come about? Here's how it comes about. Donald Trump and Michael Cohen's defense to the lawsuit is we have a valid arbitration agreement, and all of this should be handled by an arbitrator and not in the courts. Right. And in fact, we agreed that it was going to be private arbitration. It could be ex parte. We didn't have to tell the other side and nobody would ever know. And it would all be kept confidential. Right. That was the plan. And on the face of it, and I've seen some legal commentators get this wrong. When you look to the agencies that were identified in the agreement as to conduct the arbitration, right, their internal rules seem to say if there's a disagreement over how this case is to be arbitrated, then that still goes to the arbitrator, right? This is a question in arbitration law called arbitration of arbitrability. So let me read the JAMS rule to you. This is one of the agencies that they picked. It's JAMS. It says, jurisdictional and arbitrability disputes, including disputes over the formation, existence, validity, interpretation, or scope of the agreement under which arbitration is sought, and who are proper parties to the arbitration, shall be submitted to and ruled on by the arbitrator. The arbitrator has the authority to determine jurisdiction and arbitrability issues as a preliminary matter. Okay. So that sounds pretty clear. That sounds like, okay, so the question as to whether this case should be arbitrated shouldn't be decided by a court, should be decided by an arbitrator. But I have actually litigated this issue. I have both won and lost on this issue in two separate cases, because that clause and the notion that you can arbitrate disputes over arbitrability is typically confined to questions about the scope of the arbitration clause. So let me explain how that comes about. You and I have, you and I have hired people, right? We've hired Brian, right? Mm-hmm. And so Brian has an arbitration clause with Opening Arguments Media LLC that covers all disputes related to or arising out of his employment agreement with us. And then let's say he has a dispute that he says is not related to us, that elsewhere on Twitter, Thomas, you defame our editor. Brian.
Sure, I'll get on it. Right. Hold on.
That's not an instruction. That's it.
Do I need to actually do
no,
this
no,
for the
No, just this is just example? A hypothetical. And so Brian then sues you for defamation, right? And your defense is no. Like, I was making fun of him in connection with his work as the editor for Opening Arguments, and that's covered by an arbitration clause. He's got to arbitrate this.
All right.
In that case, right? That would be the classic example of arbitrating over arbitrability, right? We would go, the case would stop and we would go to an arbitrator and the arbitrator would say, okay, we need to figure out whether Brian's claim of defamation against you, Thomas, was intended to be covered by the arising out of or in connection with the agreement that contains the arbitration clause. And so then the arbitrator would rule that, you know, as a threshold matter. And if he says it's within it, then you would proceed to arbitration on the merits of the dispute. And if the arbitrator said, no, this is outside the clause, then and only then does Brian get to go to court.
Mm.
Okay. That's the way it typically works. But notice that all of that hypothetical depends upon there being a valid agreement to arbitrate in the first place. If there's no valid agreement to arbitrate at all, then there's nothing for the arbitrator to do.
Gotcha.
And this is covered not only by a replete law in California, but by a provision of the Federal Arbitration Act. The specific provision is 9 U.S.C. 4. And it says this: a party aggrieved by the alleged failure, neglect, or refusal of another to arbitrate under a written agreement for arbitration may petition any United States district court which, save for such agreement, would have jurisdiction. Okay, that's what Donald Trump has done. Donald Trump and Michael Cohen have said, yeah, we're aggrieved because Stormy Daniels signed an agreement to arbitrate and she's not agreeing to arbitrate. So we want relief. So then 9 U.S.C. 4 says how that relief comes about. The court shall hear the parties, and upon being satisfied that the making of the agreement for arbitration or the failure to comply therewith is not an issue, the court shall make an order directing the parties to proceed to arbitration in accordance with the terms of the agreement. Here's the critical part. If the making of the arbitration agreement or the failure, neglect, or refusal to perform the same be an issue, the court shall proceed summarily to the trial thereof. And that's what Michael Avenatti, attorney for Stormy Daniels, has just filed a motion for the court to do. to proceed within 90 days to a trial on the narrow question of whether there is a valid arbitration agreement, whether there was, whether the making of the arbitration agreement was either invalid because if Donald Trump wants to continue to raise the I'm not really DD, he's the only person who can enforce the agreement, as we've previously discussed. And so right. there's no arbitration clause. EC does not have the right to invoke it. Or if Donald Trump is a party to the agreement, that the agreement was formed for criminal purposes, right? That is to hide, among other things, an illegal campaign contribution. So how do you proceed to a trial on the issue of the making?
Can I just clarify real quick? Because some people have said this, like, so can you briefly explain why EC, that's the fake corporation, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
Why that, this can't just be, oh, it's a valid agreement between the corporation and Stormy Daniels. Because I think people have said that, like, oh, it's just, he doesn't have to be involved. It can just be between that fake corporation.
Yes. That it's a good question, because it certainly is possible to have written an agreement that would have given EC the right to arbitrate. But that's not how this agreement was written. And if you turn to the attachment, right, which lists the underlying settlement agreement that's in Stormy Daniels' complaint, it's attached to the amended complaint. It says under the section of remedies, this is the entirety of the remedies, right? So that's Section 5.0, paragraph 5.1 is DD's remedies for breach of agreement, right? And it says
okay.
that the harm shall render PP liable to DD for any and all damages, disgorgement of monies. It basically, to summarize, because this goes on for two pages, all of the power in the agreement. And again, section 5.0, it's pages 9 through 11 of the confidential settlement agreement, all of them vest only the right to file an arbitration with DD and not with EC. So okay. there you go. And I will add after our episode that allegation is made explicit in the amended complaint that was filed 2 days ago by Stormy Daniels. It says, look, one of the reasons to believe that the arbitration agreement is void is because if there was no agreement, if Donald Trump is not a party to this agreement and knew nothing about it, then he's the only one that can invoke the arbitration clause. Now, there is a doctrine of intended third-party beneficiary. So EC is not without any arguments in this case. Maybe we'll delve into it if that's the path that this litigation takes. I don't think it will be, because again, Trump has joined as a party. So it's not. You can enforce an arbitration agreement as an intended third party beneficiary. I don't think on the facts that EC would have standing to do that here, because the recitals, the previous paragraphs, the description of the irreparable harm, all of those things are described only in terms of the relationship between Stormy Daniels and DD. And there's no harm to EC listed anywhere in the agreement. And so I don't see a conservative court other than, a Trump loyalist concluding that that there would be any reason, any ability for EC independently to enforce the arbitration award.
Okay.
But
you're saying that this agreement is like invalid.
Yes.
This is not I'm just curious. A skeptic might be wondering, like, if that's true, what's going on here? Why is it taking so long for, why all this hubbub when the actual agreement is invalid because it involved something illegal? Like, how long should it take to for somebody to be like, yeah, this is invalid. You can't do this.
Yeah. Well, and that's what this motion is meant to do. This motion asks okay. for a jury trial on the issue of whether there is a valid
okay.
arbitration agreement. And it asks for that within 90 days of ruling Ooh. On the motion. And this is really the genius of the motion. How could you possibly resolve a jury trial on whether this agreement was validly formed or not? Well, you've got to get some discovery, right? And so here's what Michael Avenatti, attorney for Stormy Daniels, is asking for in discovery. He's saying, okay, the law says we've got to try, we've got to proceed summarily to trial quickly in order to figure out whether there is a valid arbitration agreement at all, right? So we need a little bit of discovery. That's a fact question. We need a little bit of discovery. So here's what we're asking for. We want a 2-hour deposition of Donald Trump. We want a 2-hour deposition of Michael Cohen. And we want 10 requests for production of documents. That's it. That's all we want. We would ordinarily get the right. These are parties. We would ordinarily get a full day to depose each witness. And we would get, I think in California, it's 30, you know, typical. But we would get lots more documents. We want super tailored, very narrow discovery requests in the next 90 days.
So they kind of tempered the request a little bit. They're throwing a bone just to point out how like light of a request it is for production of documents and deposition.
It is supremely reasonable. If this were any other case, right? If this were, right, Stormy Daniels versus person A and person B
contract.
And the question is, and she says, look, this is not, you know, there are irregularities in the contract. It was formed for an illegal purpose, right? Then absolutely, this is the procedure. And if the plaintiff said, hey, look, I got to have limited discovery here in order to prove whether this actually took place. Remember, right, Donald Trump and EC, that's the side that is arguing that there's a valid arbitration clause, right? So they bear some burden of proof, right? So they've put forward, they've said, look, here's the paper and it's signed. And Stormy Daniels has said, yeah, look, but it's not signed by the person who needs to invoke it. And by the way, there are reasons to believe that the entire agreement itself is fraudulent. That's a fact question. I feel really, really good. I mean, if I were on the other side, it's really tough to say, boy, we're not going to give you a 2-hour deposition. We're not going to answer, you know, 10 discovery requests. Now, you know, look, what's going to happen is they are not, whether ordered to or not, you know, they are not going to sit for those. Michael Cohen might, but Donald Trump is not.
Yeah.
I don't think he's going to sit for that deposition, and I don't think he's going to produce the documents. But we'll have to see. Once you get a president under oath, you know, look, as we saw with Bill Clinton, right, that was the moment. We've talked about this before. We've talked about the differences. Let's talk about the similarities. There would not have been articles of impeachment in the House of Representatives without Bill Clinton sitting for a deposition and giving false testimony under oath, right? He did do that.
Right. And Bill Clinton had like one thing he needed to lie about.
Yeah.
It was like one thing. Trump has 70 different ways this has to be consistent that I would be amazed if he could pull.
Also, off. Bill Clinton was a practicing lawyer, right? Like, remember the whole, you know, this is
not an idiot.
Yeah. This depends on what the definition of is, and, you know, and you could argue that, you know, he parsed words too carefully in his depositions. I know Michael Avenatti would love to depose Donald Trump. I would love to depose Donald Trump. I can't. But again, you know, as we saw this week, right, John Dowd left President Trump's legal team. They searched high and low. They brought in a new guy that literally I know nothing about. He's from like Tuscaloosa, Alabama or something. He's somebody I've literally never heard of. And so Trump has this unknown dude and one of the world's dumbest human beings in Jay Sekulow advising him. So we'll see where this goes. I can't wait.
All right. I got to ask for the listeners, you don't have it on the agenda here, but I know people are wondering, what are the implications of the 60 Minutes interview? I mean, is that the kind of thing where it seems as though already before that, Trump's lawyer was saying that she's, you know, violated the thing 20 times and so therefore $20 million. So is that interview, the 60 Minutes interview, a case of them saying, well, they already got us on that. Like, we already allegedly violated it so much that there's no reason we can't just do this interview.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Doing the interview would very clearly violate the agreement if the agreement were enforceable, and that illustrates uh, the the high level of confidence, which I think is warranted, in the Stormy Daniels camp that that this agreement is not going to be enforceable, will never be enforced against her. So, you know, the reason I'm not covering the 60 Minutes interview is because I don't think it adds to the legal analysis, right? I mean, you know, you hopefully you watched
it. But I mean, we need to at least cover that it doesn't add to the legal analysis.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. I think it's worth asking the question. I was explaining why we didn't do a whole segment on it. I obviously,
gotcha.
Atmospherically, I think the fact that Stormy Daniels comes off as an intelligent, articulate woman is fantastic. I think that it, the continuing presence in the background of attempting to show that this agreement is invalid. Remember, the goal on that is to get media outlets to the level where they are comfortable in paying or running the full Stormy Daniels story. Right. Like that's how this began. And so the more you can demonstrate like, nobody, you're not going to be complicit in $1 million per violation because this thing is just not, you know, nobody's ever. I know they've filed a lawsuit, but like, do you really think I would be encouraging my client to do something that's going to cost her $1 million a pop? Like, you know, that's the message that Avenatti is trying to promote by sending Stormy Daniels out to talk to 60 Minutes.
And also any legal points made in the second half about the Greek basketball player for the Milwaukee Bucks? Is that anything that doesn't add to it? Oh, no, that was a really good sound. Everybody, I bet watched that. It's funny because the East Coast people all wanted to watch the 60 Minutes interview and the NCAA basketball game was going long. So like a whole bunch of people who don't care about basketball were like, where's my Stormy Daniels? And then after Stormy Daniels, the segment was on the Milwaukee player that was really cool, by the way. So check it out. Anyway. All right. Does that cover what you were not wrong
that
about?
That covers what I was not wrong about.
Okay. Well, we've got the other embodiment of Schrodinger's Andrew to consider. And let's go to our next segment. Andrew was wrong.
I'm asking you if you know the difference between right and wrong.
I discovered at a very early age that if I talk long enough, I could make anything right or wrong. So either I'm God or truth is relative. And in either case, booyah.
Oh, interesting. It's just the average person has a much harder time saying booyah to moral relativism.
Andrew, what were you wrong about?
Yeah, I was wrong about a bunch of things. So let's knock them out as quickly as possible. Number one, I described the first judge in our Watergate segment as Judge Sirica, and a bunch of folks wrote in to say that it is pronounced Sirica. So there you go. Definitely wrong on that one. Number two, I was wrong also in our Watergate discussion in describing how John Dowd had testified regarding the White House recording system. That's true that he did. Several people, including Bill and Benjamin, wrote in separately to say that the first person to reveal the Watergate taping system was Alexander Butterfield, the White House Deputy Chief of Staff, who was testifying before the Senate Select Committee. And there is a super fascinating Washington Post article that I'm going to link in the show notes that kind of talks about his internal moral dilemma as he was preparing to go testify before the Senate, because he was the guy who installed this. Well, who paid people to install the system. And he was asked the question, right? He was asked to testify. And he said, I kind of had made up my mind that I was going to go into this hearing and I wasn't going to lie. But if they didn't ask helpful questions, I wasn't going to volunteer anything, right? And
it's interesting,
which is a perfectly valid way to approach a deposition. It puts the onus on the lawyer to ask good questions, and so the lawyers and the initial hearing is not taped, so there's some dispute as to whether it was a Democrat or Republican who asked the key question. Butterfield thinks it was the Republican minority ranking member on the committee, but in any event, he was testifying about how the president used a dictaphone to record messages to his secretary, who would type it up, and then after that, the senator, again, Butterfield thinks it was a Republican, said, "Were there ever any recording devices other than the dictaphone system you just mentioned?" And he sat there and then said, "Yes, there were." And So this kind of neat accident of history of based on a lawyer asking a good question in a deposition. And it really is. We have a lot of law students who listen to the show, so I'll add this for trial practice. When you say, you know, how did the president record stuff? And then somebody says, well, you know, he had a dictaphone that he would use and he would record things and give it to his secretary. Mm. Whenever anybody has answered an open-ended question with a specific, you always ask the question, okay, thanks for telling us about the dictaphone. Was there anything else? Right. And you keep
you
going.
Close all those loose ends.
And you close up the loop. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I definitely would have just forgotten. I think that's, it sounds like you need some real skill to do that properly. That's interesting.
Yeah. So those are the two minor things. The big thing that I was wrong about, that I am super happy to have been wrong about, is the Maryland and District of Columbia emoluments lawsuit against Donald Trump, which we discussed way back in Opening Arguments episode 78. The United States District Court for the District Court of Maryland just released its opinion yesterday in response to the motion to dismiss by Donald Trump. And the District Court ruled that Maryland and D.C. do indeed have standing to proceed with their emoluments lawsuit. So I went back and listened to OA 78. You guys could do that, too. It was a pretty good episode. And in that episode, I raised two areas of concern, two doubts about this emoluments lawsuit. And I want to tell you about how the district court came to a different conclusion than the one I came to. I want to say at the outset, you know, as another, this is an Andrew was wrong. Some of the things I was right about was that I said these are serious allegations, and that but for these two issues, I think the governments will have standing to talk about the injury, right? These are injuries that are related to the fact that Donald Trump is using his position as president to essentially fundraise for his properties, right? And so if you have, as the states do, both a state interest in non-Trump properties, and B, a general, it's what's called a parens patriae interest in making sure that your citizens are not unfairly induced to spend money in one place where, you know, they shouldn't otherwise be facing that pressure, then yeah, like having a president who is using his powers to divert people to Trump properties is absolutely the kind of thing in principle that you would think a court would be able to address. But I raised two questions. I said, number one, whether the domestic and foreign emoluments clause provide for a right of action that vests in the government, right, in the state of Maryland and in the District of Columbia. This is essentially the questions of justiciability and the political question doctrine, each of which we have talked about at some length. And here's how the district court resolved that. It said the foreign emoluments clause, which we've talked about in a previous episode with our buddy Seth Barrett Tillman, says no person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States shall, without the consent of Congress, accept any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatsoever from any king, prince, or foreign state. Okay, that one involves Congress, but it involves only the consent of Congress. And in the absence of the consent of Congress, that it's reasonable to think that it could be enforced by the states. And that the domestic emoluments clause, which basically prohibits the president from receiving any compensation other than his salary, right, contains no limitation that it must be enforced by Congress. So even though, as I pointed out in the episode, there is no case law saying states can enforce this emoluments clause. This is what we call a question of first impression.
There's no rule saying a dog can't play basketball.
Exactly right. It is the Air Bud defense. So
all right.
They say at some length that the Supreme Court has decided other cases involving constitutional provisions containing similar consent of Congress provisions. And so they cite one involving the merits of a tonnage clause challenge and one involving that a tax violated the export import clause. How you weigh that, where you think the Fourth Circuit is going to come out on that, it's a question of first impression. So it's tough to say, but that's how the district court answered that first question. And then the second question, the one that I thought was a more serious impediment, and I continue to think will be a serious impediment, is a case called Mississippi versus Johnson. And that involved Southern states seeking to enjoin President Andrew Johnson from enforcing the Reconstruction Acts in those Southern states.
Mm.
And it is 150 years old, and it basically says you cannot enjoin the president in the performance of his official duties. And I view that as a pretty solid barrier to this case, because what this lawsuit seeks is a declaratory judgment, but also injunctive relief enforcing the terms of that declaratory judgment, right? A declaratory judgment that says, hey, running around directing foreign nationals and others to go stay at Trump properties is a violation of the Emoluments Clause. That's the declaratory relief. The injunction is, and by the way, Mr. President, you have to stop doing that. And I view Mississippi v. Johnson as standing for the principle that you can't issue a broad, open-ended injunction telling the president to stop doing stuff, right? That violates separation of power. Mm. It's just, it's not going to happen. The district court disagreed with my analysis.
Oh, wow.
Here's what they said. They said the president also argues that the court lacks authority to issue a declaratory judgment. In support of this proposition, he relies primarily on a statement in Justice Scalia's concurring opinion in Franklin versus Massachusetts. Right. And then they'd previously cited Mississippi v. Johnson. Then they cite, and apparently Trump's lawyers decided to argue from this concurrence at oral argument. That seems preposterously stupid to me. But again, you know, Trump's lawyers not being that smart is kind of a running theme of this episode. So and then the court says, number one, a concurrence isn't law, which is true. And then number two, subsequent cases have cast doubt on the sweeping character of Scalia's characterizations of laws in his concurrence, which again is a, you know, is a feature of Scalia concurrences. He liked to speak in broad brush. So Scalia said the court cannot remedy appellee's asserted injury without ordering declaratory or injunctive relief against appellant President Bush. And since the court has no power to do that, the appellee's constitutional claim should be dismissed. And what the district court has said is, look, the court doesn't have no power to issue declaratory or injunctive relief. We know that from the Nixon and Clinton cases. And they're correct in as far as that goes. With respect to distinguishing Mississippi versus Johnson, the district court has said, yeah, Mississippi v. Johnson says you can't enjoin the president in the performance of his official acts. But enriching his businesses is not an official act of the president. Encouraging foreign dignitaries to stay at Trump hotels and patronize his golf courses has nothing to do with the duty of the president. That's a pretty good point. I think if the Fourth Circuit is going to reverse on this, I think it will be on the Mississippi versus Johnson question. But, they may well hold that the district court is correct. But the really, really important thing, and this is what I absolutely want to make sure I get at, is this doesn't immediately go to the Fourth Circuit. That's the beauty of this case, right? When you lose a motion to dismiss, that means the case goes forward, right? You only get to appeal from a final order. So if you win on a motion to dismiss, that disposes of your case with finality. You get to immediately appeal it. When you lose, the court is not saying we think Donald Trump has violated the Emoluments Clause. The court is only saying we think the state of Maryland and the District of Columbia have the right to bring a lawsuit alleging that Donald Trump has violated the Emoluments Clause. So what's going to happen? The court will permit discovery on this issue. Brian Frosch, Attorney General of the state of Maryland, has said he seeks to uncover, among other things, Donald Trump's tax returns in discovery.
They'd be able to get that. I mean, if the case is just about Donald Trump saying stuff that, you know, leads people to stay in his hotels or whatever, would they really be able to get tax returns?
So tax returns are discretionary to be ordered by the judge. There are cases that permit it and there are cases that don't. The question in discovery is whether something is likely to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. So what the attorney general is going to argue, right, what I would argue if I were in his spot, and you know, is, hey, we need a couple of years of tax returns before he was president in order to establish the baseline. And we need his tax returns while he was president in order to ascertain whether he's recouping an improper benefit to himself. And I think they have a pretty good chance of carrying that argument in front of this judge. Wow. So they're going to ask for discovery. The judge is going to order some form of discovery, right? Even if they limit on the time, like they're going to get some discovery, right? It's a trial. You get discovery. Trump will refuse. The court will issue sanctions, right? And then Donald Trump will go to another court to get an injunction blocking that sanctions order. And then that will then proceed up on expedited appeals through the process. But in the meantime, this is operative, good law, and binding on Donald Trump. So I was wrong.
So I'd like to point out that you were wrong about a handful of things. Well, the first two were very minor, but your batting average is still like 99.7%. No, and also when it comes to this emoluments lawsuit, you were pessimistic about it.
Absolutely.
Like.
So absolutely.
I just want to chime in to say that you are doing your best to stay moored to the truth and not get carried away. And we all appreciate it.
So there we go.
All right. Well, that concludes Schrodinger's. Is it Schrodinger or Schrodinger?
I think it's
Schrodinger's Andrew. Oh, yeah. Either way. Well, we'll do a future Thomas was wrong where I mispronounced it. But all right. Thanks so much for those admissions of guilt, Andrew. We will all proceed to sue you for being wrong.
There you go. All right, Thomas, it is that time. It is our co-favorite time of the week, Hall of Fame Patron Friday, in which we thank our Hall of Fame patrons, our all-time greats, who not only keep the show going, support us at $5 an episode or more on patreon.com/law, but gain with that the amazing right to make us say all sorts of crazy things every week. So,
and they exercise that right.
And yes, they do. So here we go. Thank you to Heather Loveridge. Elisa said, yikes, that's a lot of pressure. Can we talk about this? So that is a follow-up on our marriage proposal from last week. So I think actually the name is Alyssa. So it's Alyssa said, yikes, that's a lot of pressure. Can we talk about this? I actually have it on good authority that she said yes, but we love the fact that we got
it. Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Congratulations, Alyssa and Matthew.
You guys did not make a big enough deal about that. Okay, Brian, put in a ding, the wedding bell, something. I don't know.
Thank you to This Week in News with Kevin and Benedict, to Prosthetic Vogon Jeltz, founder of the John Bolton Fan Club, Anonymous, thank you to Andrew Taught Me the Penile Code, Adopt a Homeless Special Prosecutor and Oppose Collusion and Obstruction, Danny Baker, That's All, No Joey Jojo Shabadoo or any other crazy long name, Greg Sullivan, The Make Hater Cake Baker Bake Gay Bays Great Gay Cake Case, C6 Sarah, wow. Sammy, Roger, but the sign said all you could eat Metcalf versus Frying Dutchman, a great Simpsons reference, Rhonda the Dork, Reagan Klein, Reasonable Risk Podcast, our first patron Danny Rosari, Adopt a Homeless Pet and Oppose Declawing and Ear Docking, the original, Occam's Chainsaw Massacre, The Wayward Willis Podcast, Philip Stromberg, Tricicular Manslaughter, CampQuest.org, 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 they're back. Squick Thinger, Is Giving All My Money to Podcasters Mismanagement, MH World Purge the Pickle, and Adverse Possession is More Than 9/10 of the Law. And I think there's supposed to be other stuff beyond that, but I think it got cut off by. So we're going to say Adverse Possession is More Than 9/10 of the Law. Thank you all.
By the way, I coined Occam's Chainsaw Massacre about David Lewis's possible world theory over on Philosophers in Space. So check that out. Claire Kincaid is greater than Ally McBeal. Who's Claire Kincaid?
Oh, Claire Kincaid is the ADA. I believe it's Jill Hennessy in the best years of Law and Order. So she was the opposite Sam Waterston. Sure.
Well, I like Ally McBeal. So Malaika Chandler. Philosophical Zombies with Pitchforks and Glow Sticks. Soul, Jim Grove, Dave Reluctant Investor in Thomas's Second Chance Surgery Center, Nichols. Say My Name, Thomas. It's Ian. No, it's, there we go. I messed it up again. Island.
I think it's Ilan. I think it's Ilan Wool, right?
No, it's Island.
All right.
It's Island. Yeah, yeah. He clarified. But okay. Well, we've talked a ton about that on Facebook. In a world where we can't trust the rules of capitalization, I can't tell the difference between capital I's and lowercase l's, and so I had no idea what that was, but it's Island. Right. Okay. Ian and Allie, I'm kind of a big deal. People know me. You think lawyers aren't funny? You should try scientists. That's a good one. Eli Bosnick, Sam Danow, Foxhole Atheist, Soggy Pants, Alec Mke, I don't know, and Adam Linda, Aaron Grady, Sakashite Fukasumi will have the Novichok al Arbiata. Frederick Elstromer, Stormy Daniels for Attorney General. Nice. Mitchell, Liz, Go Orange, Weeks. Stop breaking the law, asshole. The sentient thought experiment machine. I'm loving all the philosophy crossovers we get. Art Vandelay, importer, exporter. Ah, that is so great because I was almost going to make an Art Vandelay importer, exporter joke a minute ago when you talked about it. During emoluments, but
I like that you and I can get together and bond over Seinfeld, at least. Maybe not any other matter of, you know, public culture over the past 30 years, including how great Cliffs of Dover is, but
Seinfeld and Simpsons. That's enough for a relationship. That's any Starry Decisis is my melodic doom metal band. And finally, Conrad Michaels, thank you so much for being the top patrons over patreon.com/law. You've got a lot of awful movies coming at you very soon. We had the Q&A. We had an appearance from Baby Opening Argument Smith. It was very fun. Now, if you get the audio version, there wasn't much audio for that. But the video, the people who watched the video at the time got to enjoy it. So thank you guys so much. You make the show happen. And reading the names every time is so fun.
Absolutely. Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, Thomas, are you strapped in and ready for your bar exam question?
Absolutely not.
Okay, here we go. A driver, returning home from a long work shift at a factory, fell asleep at the wheel and lost control of his car. As a result, his car collided with a police car being driven by an officer who was returning to the station after having responded to an emergency. That is some truly bad luck. The officer was injured in the accident and later sued the driver in negligence for her injuries. The driver has moved for summary judgment, arguing that the common law firefighter's rule bars the suit.
What?
Should the court grant the motion?
All right.
So this tests your knowledge of the common law firefighter's rule.
Yeah, I can't wait.
A, no, because the firefighter's rule does not apply to police officers. B, no, because the police officer's injuries were not related to any special dangers of her job. C, yes, because the accident would not have occurred but for the emergency. Or D, yes, because the police officer was injured on the job.
Okay, so if I had to guess, based on all the context, which it doesn't seem that hard, but it sounds like the common law firefighter's rule might be something to do with the fact that, you know, firefighter's job is dangerous. They come in, they're fighting fires. Maybe they'll get injured on your property or something. I'm just going to guess it has something to do with that. Like you're not going to be liable for them because it's a dangerous job already. You know, I'm hoping it's something to do with that. So the question is, would that apply in this case, which is a driver is just driving home from a long shift and collides with a police officer. The car is being driven, returning to the station after having responded to an emergency. That doesn't sound like, in the course, I mean, they're still on the job technically, but they're just returning to the station. I mean, A is really easy. No, because the firefighter's rule does not apply to police officers. That's a very literal, that's the Scalia answer. But I'm gonna go ahead and just assume, and again, this is all based on me just guessing what any of this is, but I'm going to assume that the firefighter's rule doesn't only apply to firefighters. That seems like the easy way out. B, no, because the police officer's injuries were not related to any special dangers of her job. That's looking real good to me right now. C, yes, because the accident would not have occurred but for the emergency. Now, that one, that's like second most plausible to me. And finally, D, yes, because the police officer was injured on the job. Ooh, maybe that's actually second most plausible. So, A, I'm just going to eliminate. Who knows? But that I'm eliminating A because that's like the super easy, you know, doesn't say a dog can't play basketball, to bring up the Air Bud rule again. Yeah, let's see. So we got a good no answer and no because it's not related to any special danger of the job. I mean, driving is kind of, it's dangerous. Driving is semi-dangerous, and it's something a police officer has to do for the job. So between C and D, it wouldn't have occurred but for the emergency. Now, I would say D is better than C. I'm going to eliminate C because I don't think the legal question should come down to whether or not the officer was specifically driving from an emergency or just driving on the course of, you know, driving from one station to another, or doing some routine police business. I can't imagine that's what it hinges on. So I think A and C are my eliminations. B and D are my good answers. So does it matter that the police officer was injured on the job? Or no, because the police officer's injuries were not related to any special dangers of her job. I'm going to go with B. I feel like in this case, the officer should be able to sue for a driver that just ran into her. So B, finally.
All right. And if you want to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out our episode on Facebook or Twitter. Include the hashtag TTTBE so we can find you. Include your reasons, therefore, and we will read all of them and we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
All right. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Thanks so much for patronizing us, everybody, on patreon.com/law. And we will see you very soon for another episode on Tuesday. Yep. See you then.
You betray the law!
Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.